The following podcast contains dramatizations of actual events. Certain situations, dialogue, names, and locations may have been changed. Some scenes are graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
Up next, even police have to admit this killer has left nothing to chance.
He is methodical and playing head games with law enforcement.
And he's determined that his victim never be identified.
It brought tears to my eyes to see that someone had been so tortured.
A photo is released, and soon the general public is on the case.
So I ended up on Web Sleuths, a place where a lot of armchair detectives, a lot of internet sleuths, a lot of true crime enthusiasts go.
They were able to identify her. So now we know who this body belongs to.
It was just a shot in the dark, and it worked out.
On an April afternoon in 1998, a couple driving in rural South Central Utah made a discovery that would consume local law enforcement for more than two decades.
It was a spring day where husband and wife are driving along. They observe something off the side of the highway that looked suspicious to them, so they stopped to see what it was. And that's when they located the body.
The female victim was wrapped in plastic, tied with rope and duct tape, rolled up in a child's playmat, and stuffed into a sleeping bag. The cause of death was a single execution-style gunshot to the head. The victim was wearing only a bra and panties and had no identification. The killer had made sure even estimating a time of death would be impossible.
This body had been in a deep freeze prior to it being found. And in April, the temperatures would have been 60, 70 degrees. In her state, you know, being in a completely horizontal, flat laid out position was apparently after death was placed in a freezer where the body could be frozen.
It was clear that whoever killed this woman wanted to make it as hard as possible to make an identification.
Law enforcement struggled to identify the woman because her fingertips had been cut off.
I don't know if they had a rough blade or whatever, but it was horrible.
All of this post-mortem activity, the wrapping of the body, the removal of the fingertips, would have taken a lot of time, a lot of privacy, and a lot of planning.
Whoever did this, I'd say they pretty much knew what they were doing. They did not want to leave any trace of this person. And they made sure.
It was very well thought out, planned, methodical. The way that this was done, I would argue it wasn't a first time that they had done something like this. It wasn't done in a hurry.
The victim was about 5 feet tall, dark-haired, had brown eyes, appeared to be around 40 years old, and could possibly be of Hispanic or Native American descent. And that's all investigators had to tell them who she was. So they turned to material found with her body.
As far as evidence, the duct tape on her face was good evidence to use to try and find out who the perpetrator was or who the suspect was. Anything that was touching her body was good evidence.
A sketch of the victim's face was released to the media, but no solid leads emerged. The National Crime Information Center and FBI database also yielded nothing. The duct tape wrapping the body was tested, but no prints or DNA were found.
The perpetrator in this case had taken some great care and precautions in hiding his identity.
At this point, the victim had no name, but she acquired one during the course of the investigation.
This Jane Doe, since she was found near Maiden Water Spring, she eventually became known as the Maiden Water victim.
As the weeks, months, and ultimately years wore on, investigators worried that would be the only name they'd ever have for this victim.
They exhausted the leads, hit dead ends, and there really became nothing more to follow up on.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Is it drained, full of energy, or can it use a jumpstart? BetterHelp wants you to know that it could be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin. What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp has connected over 3 million people and counting with licensed therapists, all 100% online. With BetterHelp, you get the benefits of in-person therapy. Plus, it's more convenient, more accessible, and more affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire, and you can get matched with a therapist in less than 48 hours. And if things aren't clicking, switch to a new therapist anytime you want. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/forensic today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/forensic.
Hopeful that forensic technology would catch up to their case, all the evidence from the Maiden Water murder was put in storage. In 2008, 10 years after the body was found, the materials used to wrap the body, the duct tape, the sleeping bag, the rope, and the playmat were tested for DNA.
They went through the evidence. They were looking for touch DNA that would indicate a suspect. And through that effort, they weren't successful in obtaining anything other than the victim's own DNA.
But the rope, or more accurately, the knots in the rope, resulted in the first solid lead. This led to 42-year-old Scott Kimball, serving life in a Colorado prison for killing four people, and he was suspected in a number of other murders.
One of the reasons law enforcement believed Scott Kimball to be a person of interest was because he had tied up other victims in the same manner.
The knots in both cases were unusually elaborate, and to the untrained eye, looked identical.
The ropes from his victim were collected from the law enforcement in Colorado, and we took our ropes and our knots from our Maiden Water victim here in Utah, and we've been referred to a knot expert that the FBI had used to analyze and compare the knots.
This expert concluded that the knots from Scott Kimball's case and the knots used to bind the Maiden Water victim, while not perfectly identical, could very possibly have been tied by the same person. And there were other reasons Scott Kimball could be the man detectives were looking for.
At the time, in 1998, Scott Kimball worked for some type of a meat company, and he would deliver frozen beef in a refrigerated truck. And he would deliver frozen beef in Colorado and Utah, some of those just the surrounding states.
Kimball clearly had the means to freeze his victim.
There was already a workup through FBI on Scott Kimball at that time. They'd done a timeline. They'd done association charts and stuff like that, kind of like the analytical stuff that needs to be done as a case goes on.
Some of Kimball's victims were shot execution style with a small caliber weapon and were dumped next to rural roadways after being wrapped in rugs and tarps. One suspected victim had both hands severed after death.
There was another female he admitted to killing. The body was apparently left and dumped and dismembered in eastern Utah. So in 2017, we got to a point where we determined that we should just go and interview him in person and see what he said.
But if investigators thought Kimball might be willing to talk, they were sadly mistaken. He knocked down the idea that the knots tied him to the Maiden Water murder.
I'm not a knot expert, but when you have a knot expert looking at these, he's just completing his analysis on them. Right. To see if they're the same knot, if the same person tied those same knots.
Well, just remember this. Right. In everything I learned from being on a Boy Scout troop, Cub Scouts, that type of thing. Things that you use in ranching, those are you know, there's basic knots, there's basic half-inches knots, there's, I mean, there's all kinds of knots. They're, they're not unique to an industry, you know.
Investigators reminded him that DNA technology was getting more sophisticated by the day. Kimball was unfazed.
Let's be honest. If you had any physical evidence on any crime, you would arrest me. If you had fingerprints, if you had DNA, if you had a witness, if you had any of those things, you would arrest me. But you can't have those because I wasn't there.
Well, there's still things we are waiting on.
You're just wasting your time. You really are. You should be looking at other suspects,
okay,
or other cold cases that you could solve.
Investigators had to concede. Scott Kimball was their one and only suspect, and they had no evidence that tied him, or anyone else for that matter, to their victim, who still had not been identified.
The case kind of went cold because we weren't really getting a lot of information from anybody, so it went cold.
In 2018, detectives on the Maidenwater case, despairing that without an identification for their victim, her case would never be solved, made an unusual decision.
We had a photograph of our victim where she was deceased. It was her face only. It was not graphic or gory. And we felt like it was something that we could potentially release to the public. We feel like we've exhausted every other possible lead and we had to do this.
These days, local news takes on a whole new meaning. A local story can go global, or at least national, in no time. And the undeniable popularity of true crime means there are scores of people whose hobby is researching real-life cases. Mandy Hart is one of them.
I found myself on a website called Web Sleuths, and then I fell into a rabbit hole of investigation, if you will. Web Sleuths is a website for people all over the world to join together and talk about crime.
Mandy became particularly interested in cold cases involving unidentified victims.
I think I was really drawn to that particular portion of the website just because I was really unaware of how many people are unidentified. And that is where I ultimately came across the case that was known at that time as the Maidenwater victim.
Mandy did a deep dive on this case, collated all the information she could find, and logged on to an organization called NamUs, which was also used by investigators in Utah working the Maidenwater case.
The case was put into the National Missing and Unidentified site, NamUs. I work with that site all the time because it's a national database. And it's for the public and it's for law enforcement. It's a great tool.
I found 8 to 10 matches and I just started going through each missing person case one at a time. And I had a photo of her deceased, which is very rare to actually have.
Mandy checked the face of the Maidenwater victim against photos of women who had gone missing.
I could rule them out based on the photo. I had her photo up on half of my screen and I went through and kind of said, no, by photo, really, until I came to maybe the 5th or 6th one. And the 5th or 6th one was the missing person profile for Lena Reyes Geddes. And there was a good photo of her face. And immediately I stopped and kind of looked back and forth and said, okay, I want to read more about this one.
37-year-old Lena Reyes Geddes went missing after leaving her Youngstown, Ohio home in 1998. In what could be more than a coincidence, the Maidenwater victim was found in Utah 12 days after Lena disappeared.
I went looking at her ethnicity. It was a match. Her height, it was a match. Her weight, it was a match. And I'm kind of like, okay, the location was the only thing that was not a match.
But the breakthrough came from something smaller than a pea. The physical description of the Maidenwater victim, the one Utah detectives had uploaded to NamUs, indicated she had a small mole on the top of her right ear. And so did Lena Reyes Geddes.
And that was the time that I literally, my blood just like went cold, that all the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and immediately I was like 100% knew that these two people that I was looking at were the same person.
True crime hobbyist Mandy Hart had a long-shot hunch she'd identified a murder victim from a 20-year-old cold case out of Youngstown, Ohio.
Like, how do you even describe, like, how I knew what I knew, you know, without sounding like a total weirdo?
To her surprise, she found a very receptive audience in a Youngstown detective.
Detective Sweeney in Ohio, he said 98-99% sure that it was her, and they needed science to prove it.
Looking at the pictures, I could see the mole in the ear. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, we do have a match here. But we needed to confirm it with DNA.
Detectives did a background check on Lena Reyes Geddes and used DNA from family members to confirm her identity.
Lena was really essentially the shining star of her family. She was a ballet dancer. She had a university degree. She was successful. She was smart.
2 years before she went missing, Lena married Edward Geddes, a successful Ohio businessman. This was his third marriage.
Edward Geddes had his own business within the city of Youngstown, and it was a commercial soap chemical business. There was a huge age difference between the two.
Detectives now got some shocking news. Edward Geddes took his own life in 2001. But he had been questioned back in 1998, shortly after Lena disappeared. Edward said Lena was visiting family in Mexico and never returned. He vividly recalled the day she left.
She'd come out of the shower and she'd have the towel wrapped around her thing. And she would put on a pair of underpants and a bra. Okay, and then she would, you know, start working with her hair. I can tell you what underpants and bra she had on. They were white cotton, and the bra. The reason I remember it is it was my favorite pants and bra. It was white cotton with pictures of apples and maybe bananas on it. Okay.
This matched undergarments from the crime scene. According to Edward, there were no problems in the marriage.
I didn't come into the airport. We kissed. I was out of the car. We kissed. Skycab picked all the stuff and they went into the Pittsburgh airport. That's the last time I saw her.
Lena's family said she'd never made it to Mexico. And ominously, Edward never reported her missing.
To me, that's suspicious. Do you think that there would be some feelings or some, you know, some idea that maybe my wife is missing, that I need to call someone?
Lena said something to a close friend in an English language class shortly before she went missing. That further raised the specter of Edward as her killer.
Lena said that if something happened to her, she passed a note to her friend so she would be able to contact Lena's family members.
Edward was abusive. He was controlling. I believe Lena wanted to leave him. She was afraid of him and wanted to be away from him. And I believe that he didn't want that to happen. He did not want Lena to leave him. And I believe that is the motive.
He appeared to be the only person with a motive. But even after all this time, it seemed there was no way to tie him to Lena's murder.
We've tested evidence 2 and 3 times with no success. No DNA was ever found other than Lena's.
But now analysts turn back to the rope used to bind Lena.
Whoever tied her up and put her in that position had to have handled that rope and made those knots. So we knew we wanted to focus on those knotted areas and that rope.
What made the rope so important as evidence was a new forensic tool called MVAC. With MVAC, it was now possible to lift DNA from all sorts of materials that were previously out of bounds, including something rough and porous like rope.
How the MVAC works is really fairly simple. Let's look at the MVAC like a mini carpet cleaner. It sprays a very clean, sterile solution on the item of evidence. and it gets that solution into the tiny nooks and crannies, the weave of something. And then you suck it up, the vacuum sucks it up, and it deposits it into a small, sterile bottle. And in that solution would be the skin cells that were deposited, hopefully, by the perpetrator.
A male DNA profile was lifted from the rope, and when tested against DNA from known relatives of Edward Geddes, the two-decade-plus mystery of who killed the Maidenwater victim was finally solved. Ultimately, even in death, Edward Geddes couldn't hide. Technology thwarted all of his attempts to conceal his role in his wife's murder.
Edward Geddes was the killer. It turned out that Edward Geddes was the one who left the DNA on those knots, on those ropes. He is the one that handled them, that tied it, that cinched it. It was him.
No one is sure exactly what happened when Edward killed Lena. What's not in dispute is that he went to unusual lengths to keep her and himself from being identified. But he made two key mistakes. He never knew that when he handled the ropes, he left his DNA behind. And in a fitting irony, when he froze Lena's body in an attempt to conceal her time of death, all decomposition stopped, which meant her face was perfectly preserved when she was later photographed by police. And that photo finally led to her identification and gave her family some measure of justice, despite the passage of more than 20 years.
I do honestly believe I was drawn into this case. Divine intervention. I don't know why. This isn't something that I had done before or that I really have done since. I'm just thankful that I was a part of it.
It wasn't just forensic science that was crucial to it. It was everybody working together. It was like putting a puzzle together, and everybody added a piece in this puzzle and helped bring the whole picture and make it clear. And we all helped each other. And when we had that DNA, that was it. The puzzle was solved.